so.
Well, I come on.
Let your gavel in.
Get your reputation over there.
You ready?
Good. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. With that gavel, I have convened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. For March the 13th, 2017, we are gathered for the purpose of a public hearing on House Bill 5016, the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And noted for the record, Senator Monroe is going to be a little bit late, and Senator Hansel needs to go testify. And so we have met our legal requirement. And with that, Ms. Dyster, will you give us an introduction?
Absolutely. Before you today and tomorrow as well is the Bureau of Labor and Industries. About 47% of their current service level budget, give or take a little bit, is comprised of general fund. You'll notice that they have other funds non-limited, and that amount has to do with wage security fund payments. Those are payments that are made on behalf of employees that didn't get a final paycheck because a business might have folded or, you know, gone out of business prior to being able to pay employees for the final time. And that is basically a diversion of unemployment insurance taxes that funds those payments that comes to the Bureau of Labor and Industries once per biennium. And it can also be utilized to pay for related administrative expenses associated with the commissioner's office and associated with administration of wage security fund payments. They also get federal funds, specifically Equal Employment Opportunity Commission for doing investigations associated with the Civil Rights Division discrimination cases associated with the Civil Rights Act, Americans with Disabilities Act, Age Discrimination in Employment Act, etc. So that's basically where the larger portions of their dollars come from. You'll also see other funds associated with prevailing wage public works construction contract fees, a transfer of revenue from the Oregon Department of Transportation to support apprenticeship and training efforts that foster diversity in the Heavy Highway Fund. And they also do sales of publications, fees for trainings, services, and seminars. And they have contracts with OROSHA for investigations into discrimination and retaliation related to injured workers and occupational safety and health. And there are also licensing fees from labor contractors that make up their other funds as well. So that gives you kind of a broad brush of sort of where the dollars come from. And hopefully that's helpful. Speak more about those as their budget presentation commences. There are no policy option packages currently funded in the governor's recommended budget. And I think that's all I have for now.
Great. Colleagues, any questions of Ms. Dyster? All right. Mr. Labor Commissioner and Team Boley, I don't know who all is coming up with you in the first tranche of presenters.
Madam Co-Chair, thank you. Co-Chair Gomberg and committee members, I'm Brad Avakian, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Seated to my right is Christy Hammond, our Deputy Commissioner. And as we like to do, we've brought you the administrators of our various divisions in order to present information about their particular divisions. I'd like for you to be able to meet them. They've got good specific information about the jobs that they do. And so seated in back of me is Paloma Sparks, our legislative director, Steve Sims, the administrator of the Apprenticeship and Training Division, Gerhard Teubel, the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division, Amy Clare, the administrator of the Civil Rights Division, Jennifer Germanson, manager of our Technical Assistance for Employers program, and Terry Bonebreak, our business service manager who handles the finances of the agency.
And so who's left back at the office.
We've got plenty of folks doing good work at the office. But each of these are experts in their own field, and we thought it was important that they be able to present to you about the things they do at the agency. For time management purposes, Madam Co-Chair, I want to let you know we don't anticipate bringing folks for public testimony tomorrow. Now, certainly people may show up, but as you just try and figure your schedule, you can count on us not bringing in folks. And as we go through our PowerPoint presentation, we may go through some of those slides relatively quickly or even pass by some that maybe give some background information about the agency but aren't as pertinent to the decisions you're going to have to make on this committee. So if you see something that we're moving through quickly and you have questions, please let us know. We'll go back to the slide or hold there. And with that, the first couple slides just give you a little bit about agency history, this one and the next. It is our job to protect Oregon's workers to support Oregon's industry sectors. We have approximately 100 FTE in the office and a $27 million biennial budget. We protect Oregon's workers through the work that we do in the state civil rights division and the wage and hour division. In the civil rights division, we enforce the state's civil rights laws with regard to employment, also housing, and public accommodations, which is the law that prevents discrimination in all public places. The wage and hour division, of course, makes sure that people get paid every dime that they've earned and that they're getting their meal and rest periods. And it is also the unit that contains, the division that contains our prevailing wage unit, where we set and enforce the state's prevailing wages.
Mr. Labor Commissioner, I don't know whether or not one of your issue experts is going to get to this, but in the civil rights area, are you complaint-driven, or are you initiating many of the investigations of your own volition? How do those come to you generally?
I can give you an overview, Madam Chair, and Amy Clark can dig in deeper if you'd like. It is primarily complaint-driven, an individual that feels that they have been treated unfairly in housing, public accommodations, or employment can file a complaint with our agency. There are some circumstances in which we use what's called the commissioner's complaint. Under Oregon law, if the labor commissioner believes that there has been a violation of one of those civil rights laws, and in certain circumstances where we think we have a particularly vulnerable population or maybe numerous people have been harmed by the act, if for some reason an individual cannot come forward, the labor commissioner has the ability to file a complaint on his or her own volition called a commissioner's complaint. When that happens, the deputy commissioner makes the final decision at the end of a hearing. Other than that, the complaint is processed in the exact same way that other complaints are processed. We support Oregon's employers in two significant ways. One, we certify all of the state's apprenticeship training facilities. So at any given time, we could have between 5,000 and 8,000 people being trained for great living wage jobs in apprenticeship facilities. We also have the state's Technical Assistance for Employers unit, which helps employers in Oregon navigate their way through complicated state and federal employment laws. The next slide gives you our organizational chart. The one after that, FTE reductions, just gives you a little historical perspective of the agency since the early 90s. And then in the next two pie charts, as Ms. Deister summarized, it lets you know the breakdown between our general funds, other funds, and then a smattering of federal and fees and other types of funds that come into the agency. And
Mr. Chair?
Excuse me. Yes, I'm sorry. I didn't see you over there. Yes, okay. Representative.
Just a quick question on the FTE reductions over the last 20-some years. What has precipitated that? Is it efficiencies or just changes in from looks like 160 and 93 down to your current 100?
Well, no, that's been legislative action. You know, we are an agency that has learned to do much more with much less. But those Those losses over the years have meant almost the complete elimination of the farm labor unit within the agency. The enforcement units are about two-thirds the size of what they were at one point. And so, those have been legislative actions that have, that we have weathered. But, at the same time, the scope of our responsibilities with regard to enforcement and training and apprenticeship have increased drastically over those years. We're an agency that's just learned to do more with less.
Thank you very much. That's a great answer. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that committee, I'm going to bring up Paloma Sparks, our legislative director. She can give you a summary of the legislation that the agency is advancing this session, and also bills that others are advancing but may have some type of an impact on the agency should they pass.
Good afternoon.
Welcome.
For the record, Paloma Sparks, Bureau of Labor Ministries. The Bureau is promoting three bills. Primarily, they are sort of more along the lines of housekeeping or streamlining. House Bill 2572 is about labor contractors. Currently, labor contractors are required to apply for a license and submit various paperwork, go through some processes every year with the Bureau. This bill would allow labor contractors who are in good standing to get licenses for 2 or 4 years. That relates to farm labor contractors, forest labor contractors, and construction labor contractors. And that will be headed to the House floor tomorrow, I believe. Then Senate Bill 298. In the 2015 session, the Bureau sought and received discretion in how we process some housing discrimination complaints. Prior to 2015, it required that if somebody elected to go to civil court, the Bureau would have to continue to represent those parties. That was costing us quite a bit in legal costs, so we got discretion passed in 2015, but that had a sunset on it, so Senate Bill 298 would remove that sunset and allow that discretion to continue forward. Senate Bill 416 is a prevailing wage rate housekeeping bill. It is really just some technical fixes, some contract language fixes. The AGC is neutral on the bill, hasn't been controversial at all. We just need to get it moving. Then, so that's all that the Bureau is promoting in terms of our interests of legislation. There are a number of bills that could have an impact on our workload going forward if they pass. House Bill 2005 and Senate Bill 752 are both pay equity legislation. They're mirror legislations on the House and Senate side. That could have an impact on what we do in the Civil Rights Division. Then House Bill 2167 and Senate Bill 292 relate to workplace bullying. That could have an impact both in the Wage and Hour and Civil Rights Divisions. Then House Bill 2193 and Senate Bill 828 relate to employee work schedules. I'm sure you've all heard about it. again, that could have a significant workload for all of our enforcement divisions, but also for technical assistance for employers who supplies a free hotline and does trainings for employers, and they could see quite an uptick in workload, I would estimate. House Bill 2194 is a prevailing wage rate bill. It involves tax credits as being defined as public funds. Currently, they're exempt from the definition of public funds. And so if you've got a private project that involves $750,000 or more of public funds, that's what triggers whether or not it's a prevailing wage, a public works project. So that could change that. House Bill 2215 I haven't seen this one moving, but if it did move, that could be a big impact. It's the right to rest, also known as the Homeless Bill of Rights. That has BOLI enforcing sort of interactions with law, between law enforcement and homeless individuals. It's also private property rights, so that could be quite an impact on our Civil Rights Division. Those would be complicated, lengthy investigations. Then House Bill 3328 would be a significant change to the existing Veterans Preference Law. It could make for some difficult investigations. It also requires that that bill requires that veterans exhaust their administrative remedy, in which case they would only be able to seek remedy through the Bureau, and only after they had exhausted all of their possibilities within the Bureau could they file in civil court. Senate Bill 301 relates to marijuana in the workplace. Currently, there's an existing Oregon Supreme Court ruling that limits employees' rights should they test positive for marijuana. That is not protected under current Oregon law. This bill could change that. Then there's a smattering of legislation throughout the building on sick time and minimum wage. Any of those could have a significant workload change. Rulemaking could be lengthy and time-consuming and difficult. So that is the universe of bills that could impact us, our workloads.
Thanks. Excuse me. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Ms. Sparks, I'm surprised you didn't mention House Bill 2856. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It says it creates community outreach and labor education program within the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and describes that. Do you know about that bill?
So, Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Nierman, I am aware of that bill. That bill would have us administering a grant fund, but otherwise would have no impact on our actual operations. It would be money sort of that filtered from the legislature through us to private entities. It wouldn't change our workload.
Not a significant change to your workload. No. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. And up next we have Steve Sims with the Apprenticeship and Training Division.
Welcome, Mr. Sims.
Thank you. Co-Chair Gomberg, committee members, Stephen Sims. I am the administrator for the Apprenticeship and Training Division at the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I'm happy to give you an overview of our operations and our budget. A lot of people hear the term apprenticeship and they think of simply teaching something to someone else, but what we do with registered apprenticeship is something a little bit different. Registered apprenticeship constitutes a series of formal legal relationships set forth by statute in ORS Chapter 660. Registered apprenticeship is paid, supervised, on-the-job training and classroom instruction based upon industry-approved standards pursuant to an agreement and a partnership, really, between employers, employer associations, organized labor groups, the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and most importantly, the apprentice. Most of the apprenticeship programs registered with our office take between 2 and 5 years to complete, depending upon the occupation. On average, it takes about 4 years for an individual to complete their apprenticeship training. Apprenticeship training is a great model for developing our workforce because the employers pay all of the apprentices' wages. There are no subsidies. They also pay the wages for the supervising journey workers, and the employers pay for the development of the related classroom instruction, and in most cases pay for the delivery of the classroom instruction. And that curriculum is not just a group of employers saying this is good. The instruction that is approved for our programs must either meet national industry standards or it must meet standards established by the State Board of Education. That means when individuals complete their program, they get a credential that's portable and is good anywhere in the United States. Our office reviews any new programs, registers them, registers the apprentices, and this is all based upon industry demand. Industry runs and operates these programs. Joint labor management committees will usually appoint staff to actually take care of the day-to-day operation of those programs. And we assist them in identifying good quality training, identifying quality industry standards, in doing outreach and recruitment of participants. Our office also tracks the progress of these individuals towards the completion of their apprenticeship program, so we can benchmark them as they go through. We can work with programs to see if they have apprentices who are not progressing smoothly and say, you might need some help in this area with making sure people can complete their programs in a timely manner. You might need to change the nature of your instruction. And we also monitor the entrance into all of our programs for compliance with state and federal civil rights and EEO requirements. In order to do that, we have to really try to facilitate partnerships with community-based organizations and education to try to feed the pipeline for our programs. That's not something we do in a vacuum. We really depend upon the input of our sponsors. And equally important, we depend upon the policy guidance of the 8-member Oregon State Apprenticeship and Training Council. Its members are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate, and the Labor Commissioner serves as the chair of the State Apprenticeship Council. I should have really been on that slide at that time. I move to this next one here and talk a little bit about our budget. As stated earlier, private employers, and where applicable, their signatory labor organization, pay for the vast cost of the operation of registered apprenticeship programs with minimal public investment. The Apprenticeship and Training Division is currently authorized at 16 FTE with a general fund budget of $3 million. So that pays for the majority of staffing in our organization. Pursuant to an interagency agreement with the State Department of Transportation, ODOT, we also administer a supportive services program to provide help to our heavy highway industry programs with outreach, recruitment, placement, and retention services for apprentices in heavy highway trades. The heavy highway trades are carpentry, laborers, operating engineers, cement masons, iron workers. Now, just because you're working heavy highway in those occupations doesn't mean that you might later on be working in vertical construction a little bit later. So these services build to assist the retention of all of these programs across the board. Those funds come from the Federal Highway Administration, constitute approximately $2.1 million per biennium. 85% of those funds go directly to supporting outreach, recruitment, retention services for apprentices. The remaining 15% is used to cover our administrative cost and pay for staff. This program's really been essential to our bigger mission of providing opportunity for all apprentices and all Oregonians. I'm happy to say that when you look at the percentage of female construction trade workers, Oregon has the highest percentage of female construction trade workers in the United States, 6.7%. But we'll see a little bit later, we really have a lot more work to do with respect to providing opportunity, true equal opportunity for women in the construction trades.
I'm just going to interrupt you for a second because I just want to go back and emphasize that point. We are leading the nation with 7% women in the construction trades.
Women in apprenticeship construction programs, Chair Gomberg, and that leads the country at 6.7%.
Who's trailing the country? I mean, what kind of numbers do they? That was a rhetorical question, and I apologize. Certainly. Please continue.
I will say, Chair Gomberg, that nationally the percentage of journey level women in the building and construction trades is about 3.1%. It's a dire picture with respect to women in the construction trades. Approximately 85% of the apprentices registered in Oregon are in the building and construction occupations. Another 8 to 9% are in utility occupations, meter persons, line persons, outside line persons, and another 6% are pursuing manufacturing careers. It's important to recognize that you don't have an apprenticeship program unless you have employers saying, I want to train this way. We're demand driven, and that leads to the high percentage of apprentices in the building and construction trades. When we experienced the employment loss in the state during the Great Recession of 2009 and 2011, our numbers understandably went down, but we have already slowly rebuilt the number of registered apprentices in the state back to where they were in 2008. Right now, today, we have 8,148 active apprentices registered in our programs. That's about the same amount of numbers the same number of apprentices we had in 2008.
As Mr. Sims, of those apprentices that are currently registered, how many of them complete the program? When you've got a universe of 8,000, how many of these are going to be successful, land jobs, and fill this workforce gap we've got?
Certainly. Co-Chair Johnson, all of our active apprentices are actually employed, but as far as how many, the completion rate for our programs, and it varies, some trades are much higher than the other, but on average about 53% of all the individuals who start their program wind up completing their program.
The reason I ask is that I had the privilege of meeting a female welder who had gone through Tongue Point, and she's out in the job market, and boy, is she proud of her trade, and is all I could think to myself is I'm going to be taking her to a lot of job fairs where there are other young women seeing the opportunity that she's been able to realize through a program like it. Hers happened to be Tongue Point. But. So 53% go on to end up with a career.
Chair Johnson, 53.1% receive a journey certificate,
right,
saying they complete their apprenticeship program. What we don't have a way of tracking is how many individuals go through their program, decide they don't want to journey out, but they continue to work in the trade or occupation. But we know we have a 53.1% completion rate. We'd like to get the known completion rate even higher if we could.
How does that stack up with any of our sister states, or do you track that kind of data?
Co-Chair Johnson, based upon anecdotal evidence, we're slightly behind Washington State. I think there, and this is for their total apprenticeship registration universe, I think that they're somewhere around 60%. Keep in mind that they're a little bit less reliant on building construction trade sector than we are. California's around 45%, but that's just based upon anecdotal evidence from talking to my counterparts in those states.
Cool. Thank you. Please continue.
As the number of apprentices have grown, as we recover from the recession, we're slowly going to see an increase in the number of journey workers completing our program. We'll see performance measures a little bit later. We strive for a minimum of 1,200 completions every year. We know from projections from the Employment Department, if we're adequately meeting the needs in the building trades occupations right now, we should be completing about 1,700 new journey workers a year. So we know we have a way to go. We are adjusting our approach to building capacity, to getting more people into program and more employers interested in the programs, not just in building and construction, but in other occupations. We're working with the Oregon Employment Department, the Oregon Department of Education, and other agencies to integrate registered apprenticeship, this heavily employer-driven strategy, as a key component of the state workforce system. Those joint strategies that we're working on include cross-training for apprenticeship staff, our staff on how the state WorkSource system works, but also WorkSource Oregon staff on how registered apprenticeship works, so their business service representatives can sell apprenticeship to their employers. We're looking at ways to increase data sharing capacity between our agencies. We're coordinating with career and technical education coordinators throughout the state to make sure that if we've got CTE programs in the building and construction trades that are turning out students, our programs can recruit from their graduates.
Mr. Sims, let me stop and ask
yes.
another question. The voters approved ballot measure 98, and there are a number of advocates in the building today discussing where the funding for that is going to come from. What impact will that have on your ability to make these linkages? Or that's a big infusion of money into the career technical education tracks. How will you make those hookups with schools that are able to take advantage of the new money?
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. I think that really talks about where we're taking our approach in providing technical assistance to our programs. Right now, when we know about CTE programs in construction and manufacturing, we send these private joint labor management committees out to talk to those schools and say, how do we coordinate something? But we often find that those programs are running on a thread. In other words, you have very dedicated CTE instructors and coordinators who use 99% of their time just putting their program on the ground and don't really have the ability to make that connection with industry to create a pathway. Depending on what happens with the implementation of ballot measure 98, we hope to actually be able to build infrastructure in order to create a partnership between what's coming out of the school and what industry has with respect to its future workforce. We're also looking, as those students come out and as we work with education and employment, to make this a system to work with local workforce investment boards and community colleges, because many of those students who come out of school with the CTE credential, if they can't get into an apprenticeship, they may go to a community college to pursue that education. Maybe we get them an apprenticeship at that time, but it's going to take partnership between our program operators, the employers, and the education system to make sure we build a true pathway so that students know where they're going. Talk a little bit about completions. That's one of our key performance measures. Again, keeping in mind the overwhelming majority of our apprentices are in the building trades, you can see that our graduation numbers peaked during the height of the Great Recession. That's because in the 3, 4, 5 years leading up to the Great Recession, we were taking lots of people in. So during the recession, they managed to graduate. Just as an interesting aside, which I did not intend on mentioning, but going back to Co-Chair Johnson's question, our retention rate during the peak of the recession actually went up a little bit to about 55%, mainly because those employers said, look, there's not a lot of work, but I've invested X number of dollars, thousands of dollars in these individuals, and we're going to keep them in. We're not going to take new apprentices. We're going to make sure this person graduates. So the employers understand the investment they're making, and they really do work hard to capitalize on that and make sure they have a finished product that they're looking for. We're going to look at our two slides from now, our current enrollment numbers. They are going up steadily, and so we believe in another year or two we're going to be back to completing 1,300 to 1,400 apprentices per year based upon the new people coming in and the amount of work that's available. I've broken the completion rates down based upon gender and ethnicity, and I think that that's very important. Our program is approved by the United States Department of Labor. That's why our completing apprentices get a certificate that's good anywhere in the country, that journey card. The USDOL requirements also mandate that all of our programs make a commitment to diversity in training and employment. And building construction trades, quite frankly, can be kind of difficult in building that diverse environment. Over the years, we've seen our registration numbers for people of color go up significantly. Not so much for women, but we've seen those numbers go up. What we've recognized, and you'll notice on the very last column under percentage of minorities completing their program, you'll see a slight increase in the percentage of minorities completing their program, but it's not proportional to their representation in the trade. We know we have to work harder with our outreach sources and, more importantly, with our programs to make sure that some of the barriers that women and people of color face in getting into programs are being addressed so that they can successfully complete their programs in a timely manner. And again, as I said earlier, attracting women and retaining them in the trades is simply a much harder nut to crack. The fact that the numbers for minorities overall have really significantly risen in the last few years, but we don't see that rise for women, tells you it's a lot easier to be a man, even if you're a person of color, in the trades than it is for women. And we don't have the answer for that, but we are working with all of our sponsors to try to figure out a solution. Again, this is just the graphic on the percentage of minority apprentices. Based upon 2015 statistics, protected class minority members made up about 18.6% of Oregon's workforce. So the division exceeded its goal for the past fiscal year of 15% new minority registrations. I'm sorry, 15% of all registered apprentices coming from protected class minority groups. More importantly, in the last calendar year, 20.7% of all new registered apprentices came from protected class groups. Our goal, as we can see, we're beginning to exceed representation as far as new registrations for apprentices. Our goal is maybe in 2 or 3 years that we have completion rates for minorities and participation rates that exceed that 18.5% figure that represents the percentage of minority representation in the workforce. The next slide just deals with newly registered apprentices, and you can see that the up and down number of individuals registered each year closely mirrors the track of the Great Recession. In fact, in 2010, you'll see we bottomed out at just over 1,000 new registrations, as opposed to last calendar year, we just fell under 3,000 new registrations. So we know that things are coming back, and it's all dependent upon demand. We believe that these registrations numbers can be driven even higher if we can fulfill our goal of getting the rest of the workforce system to see registered apprenticeship as the preferred training model, not only for the construction trades, but for every single occupation. The concept of industry standards, supervised, paid on-the-job training, and classroom instruction can work in just about any job field you could select. In order to do that, we need to continue our work with the Employment Department and our other workforce partners to address what, based upon some research we've done, is just a general lack of knowledge or understanding about what registered apprenticeship is and how it works. We need to increase our ability to share data. There are plenty of people in the Employment Department's database who might be interested in apprenticeship and might have the necessary skills and tools, but we're not connecting with them. And connecting with our high school CTE programs to make sure that they're being driven to the right place. So we want to drive this number higher, not only with building and construction, utilities, manufacturing. We believe this is applicable to just about any occupation. So we're making some program changes. We're going to continue to develop those relationships with our workforce partners, look at ways to exchange data with other agencies, but more importantly, change the conversation about registered apprenticeship and get people to see that workforce development is not passive. It's not a situation where employers expect our K-12 system simply to pop out workers. We want to build a joint investment with our employers and with the system. Our goal is to get employers, educators, employer associations, organized labor talking about apprenticeship, and we find that our current sponsors in the building and construction trades are our best advocates. They know how it works and they support it. The difficulty comes in utilizing all of the various assets of our state workforce system. That means that we have to look at new ways to incentivize an interest in registered apprenticeship. And one of those ways are a couple of grants that the Employment Department applied for on our behalf. One deals with manufacturing, and basically we have a $3 million grant to create new apprenticeship programs in advanced manufacturing. We are busy reaching out to the statewide employer associations, the industry clusters within the state workforce system, and our community college partners to find out what it is employers are looking for and what kind of things can we put in place. If there's instruction that's missing in our community colleges to supplement manufacturing training, we'll pay for it. If industry associations need some startup funds in order to build their program, we'd like to provide that with those grant dollars. So we're trying to figure out how to incentivize this process.
Mr. Sims, is employment going to make some of those expenditure decisions, or are you, or are, do you and employment do it together? The only reason I ask is I've heard that money spent about 4 times, and I'm curious who has the expenditure authority.
Co-Chair Johnson, I want to answer this question properly. A lot of this is associated with the OMIC project in Scappoose, and that's a separate pot of money. Our manufacturing grant is separate and discreet, and pursuant to the terms of the grant proposal that we submitted to USDOL, it is a joint decision. Every time we make a decision about do we want to invest in this strategy, we sit down at the table, employment in our office, we bring in some of our existing manufacturing programs and say, where does this go? We want to, as an aside again, collaborate and do some early building in support of OMIC, So if we can get some more programs going with Boeing and some of their supply line employers, some small programs, until that center is built, we're going to be there. On the other hand, when we found a small tool and die company in Lane County that said they really just want to train a half a dozen people, we said let's make those investments. So as far as the small dollars in our grant, that's a joint decision.
Cool.
We also have a grant with the Employment Department generally to help us with that training and education for the Employment Department staff and all of the workforce staff throughout the state, and also with respect to creating new promotional materials and making our data systems talk to each other so that we're using the information that's currently in the various state workforce databases. That concludes my presentation with respect to the Apprenticeship and Training Division. I would like to now turn it over to the Wage and Hour Administrator, Gerhard Toybell.
Before you do, let's take some questions, if you don't mind, Mr. Sims. Representative Meek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sims, is there any research available for our as our baby boomers start to phase out? Do we have any information related to, you know, need or loss of skilled workforce, and what the difference will be as time goes on?
Through the co-chairs, Representative Meek, we do have, with respect to the construction and manufacturing workforce, information available from the Employment Department. They do a fairly complex analysis of the number of people in these occupations, completing apprenticeship programs, completing community college programs, Job Corps programs, other related type of programs. Even when we put together the numbers from community college, Job Corps, other training, private training institutions in the same area together, we're probably falling about 15% short of meeting the demand in construction. It looks like we're even further behind, probably around 30 to 35% with respect to meeting the need in manufacturing. Now, those surveys and those samples they put together can't be all-encompassing. They don't take into account workers coming in from out of state. But we're not meeting our need, and that's a disservice not only to Oregonians who are looking for employment, but also to those employers who are saying, how do we maximize our skill within the state of Oregon?
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Yep.
I think part of our CTE Measure 98 is we need a lot of, we're promoting, we want folks, the kids to go to college, but I'd like to see more advocacy for kids to see they have an alternative. And if we can somehow relay that to the schools, that and let these students know that this is a great path for you and it's needed and you'll be employed right away and you can do these apprenticeships, and I don't know if there's a program out there, if you guys are able to facilitate that, but I think that'd be a fantastic way when we're talking about workforce development, that let schools and communities know that these jobs are out there. And college, you'll get a certificate, your journeyman's card, and a great career. So I'd love to see that as being. Thank you, Mr. Sims. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Meek, let me just add one thing to what Mr. Sims may want to say about that.
Reintroduce yourself.
Brad Avakian, Commissioner of Labor and Industries. Going on maybe 4 years ago, this legislature created the CTE grant fund, and you've put millions of dollars into the grant fund over the last couple biennia anyway, and that's led to the reintroduction of 21st century shop classes to over 340 middle schools and high schools in Oregon. It's brought back the kind of career training that you're talking about to nearly 150,000 students. Measure 98 has kind of upped the game with respect to bringing this back in a more systematic way, but that CTE grant fund still exists within the Department of Education, and if it continues to be funded, you'll see those kind of programs coming back. And I think there have been additional efforts, not just in starting those programs, but in building relationships between local apprenticeship programs and employers to those returning programs in our high schools.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ma'am.
Senator Monroe.
It's interesting. I just came from a 45-minute press conference dealing with how we can implement Measure 98. So look forward to working with you, Mr. Commissioner, and seeing if we can figure out a way to do that.
Mr. Sims, do you get any feedback from the schools as that's quantifiable, not just anecdotal, as to how well prepared the kids are, just at a rudimentary level, leave aside the CTE specific skills, but in sort of the core math ability to read and write instructions, how well is our basic core student prior to arriving at an apprentice threshold?
Co-Chair Johnson, this comes not from our education partners, but this comes from our program operators. And they tend to state that students who come to them directly out of high school or a couple of years out of high school, but they have not had an applied learning background, they have not studied CTE, or they have not been in a specific curriculum, frequently not only need remedial math, but what's more important is there's a soft skill that's missing, the ability to understand that everything that they learn kind of needs to be in an environment where it can be used. So it's almost like a missing skill with respect to applying what you've learned. And that's pretty standard from all of our programs, regardless of the industry or occupation. They just don't know how to apply what they know.
The lamentation I hear from many of my employers are just what you talked about, the soft skills, plus the gap, not applying what they know in a context that's relevant to companies that still rely on a natural resource environment. 8 o'clock isn't a guideline. That's the time we start. 5 isn't when you decide you're going to go. I mean, you don't knock off at 3:30 because you're tired, those sorts of things. Plus the pernicious effects of drugs in the workplace. Do you know? Well, this is unfair to ask you. You're an executive agency, and I won't. I was going to comment on a bill that will make it harder to dismiss a person with marijuana in their system. Let's just let that one go. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sims.
I appreciate
Sims.
That, Co-Chair Johnson. I'd like to introduce Gerhard Toybel, the Administrator for the Wage and Hour Division.
Welcome, and sign in, please.
I thought we were going to kill that bill.
I hope we are. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. I'm Gerhard Teubel. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon to talk to you about the Wage and Hour Division's activities and how the division's budget relates to that. The Wage and Hour Division enforces laws in a number of different areas which apply to Oregon's 100,000 plus business establishments and 1.7 million workers. The purpose of these laws is to establish basic workplace standards in the areas of wages and working conditions, to keep minors safe in the workplace, to license labor contractors in order to minimize wage disputes in agricultural employment and among forest and construction laborers, to give employees access to sick time when it's needed, and to ensure the state-mandated wage rates are paid on public works projects. The division's activities are comprised generally of three kinds: efforts to resolve wage disputes between employees and employers through the wage collection program, efforts to ensure compliance with minimum standards through investigations of complaints, and efforts to affect compliance by providing information to the public about wage and hour regulations. As this chart shows, the Wage and Hour Division's funding sources are basically four. The largest share is provided by the Wage Security Fund. As Ms. Dicer mentioned earlier, money for the fund comes from a diversion of 0.3% of employment taxes during the second calendar quarter of every odd-numbered year. So biannually, there's a shift of these funds. Employers do not pay this in addition to the tax that they pay to the Employment Department. These monies go directly into the Wage Security Fund. The purpose of the fund, which was created way back in 1985, is to provide for the payment of wages to workers whose the employers have gone out of business and are unable to pay the workers at the time of termination. So qualified claimants may be paid from the fund for the amount they earn in the 60 days prior to the closure of the business, or the 60 days prior to the termination of their employment, up to a maximum of $4,000. As such, the fund is used to make these kinds of payments, to workers, as well as to pay the costs of administering these payouts, investigating these kinds of cases. And as you may remember from the last legislative session, the legislature approved three new positions for BOLI to use to engage in proactive enforcement of wage and hour laws, and those three positions are funded by the Wage Security Fund as well.
How difficult is it to reconstruct some of those cases if the company is uncooperative in their final existence? Give us a little profile.
Sure. Senator Johnson is actually going to talk about this in a later slide, having to do with a performance measure around the Wage Security Fund. But it can be difficult. I mean, if you imagine that we're investigating a company or a claim for a company that's now defunct, it's out of business. So for some companies, there's really no incentive there to work with us to provide the kinds of records that we would normally like to see in order to corroborate whether, you know, the claim is legitimate or has merit or not. That is, you know, to provide payroll records or time records for the workers. Surprisingly, even though many the companies, when they go out of business, many of them do cooperate with us, they do still have a concern about their workers and so want to make sure that the workers get paid, even if they're not able to do that. So they go out of their way to provide those kinds of records. And sometimes, you know, we have other sources that we can go to. Sometimes from the claimants themselves, they can provide us with copies of their time cards or, you know, paycheck stubs from previous pay periods, so we know how much they're being paid, how much they typically work, and then we can extrapolate from there in order to get a pretty good picture of what any individual is owed.
Thank you. Co-Chair Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you for that information. This committee has been exploring the issue of delinquent debt with a variety of agencies, and one of the issues that we have addressed is the difference between delinquent debt and absolutely uncollectible debt, which I think is part of what you're talking about here. And of course, there is a process for writing off uncollected debt, but I note that you folks did not write off any of the debt that you're talking about last year. Could you just explore that a little bit with me? What happens when you identify a debt as uncollectible? Do you keep it on the books, or do you at some point clear some of those accounts out?
Co-Chair Gomberg, I don't know that I can specifically answer about writing off debt. I mean, the debt that we have, at least through the Wage and Hour Division, is debt owed in large part to, say, workers, but in some cases also civil penalties and such that is owed to the agency. Those are achieved through orders and then judgments that we receive against an employer, and those judgments are good for a certain number of years. So, for example, 6 years. So after 6 years, that debt essentially goes away unless we choose to renew that judgment. Some cases there's good reasons for doing that. Many times there isn't. I mean, with these kinds of cases, if we're trying to recover, say, Wage Security Fund payouts that we've made, you know, the business is gone and the likelihood of collecting is slim unless that business has gone through a bankruptcy, for example. So we'll file with the bankruptcy court, and sometimes we're able to manage to recover something along those lines or through that process.
Right. I'd like to explore this a little further, but not right now, so I'm going to let you go ahead and continue.
Okay, thank you. The second largest funding source for the Wage and Hour Division is the fees that public agencies pay for when they award a public works contract. These represent, you know, 1% of the contract, 1/10 of 1% of the contract price. There's a minimum of $250 that an agency would pay, up to a maximum of $7,500. These fees support the activities of the division's prevailing wage rate unit, which in addition to investigating complaints filed on these projects, also provides technical assistance to contractors and contracting agencies, as well as publishing the prevailing wage rates twice per year. One quarter of the division's budget is comprised of the general funds. This portion funds the general wage collection program, handling wage claims filed for workers, for example, and the enforcement of workplace standards like rest and meal periods and rest periods for the expression of breast milk, or the enforcement of labor contractor licensing regulations, farm and forest labor enforcement generally, the enforcement of child labor laws, and finally the enforcement of the sick time regulations. And finally, a small percentage of the division's budget is made up from fees paid by labor contractors when they apply for their licenses, and essentially that those fees pay for the position that is charged with processing the license applications. This slide provides you with a summary of some of the division's activities. This is on an average basis over the last 5 years. As you'll see, every year, an average of 1,300 claims are filed by workers seeking to recover unpaid wages from their employers. Typically, these are claims for final wages. That is, you know, the employment has terminated, the employee didn't get paid, so the employee files a wage claim with us. But it also might be wage claims for the non-payment of minimum wages, non-payment of overtime, or in some cases for deductions, unlawful deductions that may have been made from an employee's wages. In the most recent fiscal year, the Wage and Hour Division collected nearly $850,000 in wages for Oregonians who filed a wage claim with the division. As I mentioned earlier, we receive a number of wage security fund claims. In fact, we receive about 400 per year from workers claiming that they didn't get paid their final wages and their employer went out of business. Since it's the program's inception, the Wage and Hour Division has paid nearly $21 million, over 19,000 displaced Oregon workers from this program. This might be a good time to mention, too, that in addition to receiving wage claims, the agency receives thousands of complaints each year about issues other than wages. That is, complaints that are not an employee coming to us and asking the Bureau to collect wages on his or her behalf, but alerting us to other kinds of complaints. For example, rest and meal period type of complaints, child labor complaints, and complaints of those nature. Incidentally, over the last year, we've received about 300 complaints regarding alleging violations of the sick time regulations, and about 40 of those have resulted in investigations. We also use.
Could you explain, for the benefit of some of our new members who haven't heard this presentation previously, how do you triage a call? How do you ascertain that the call is meritorious? How much money is expended or staff time prior to a determination that maybe you have a spurious claim or you have a disgruntled worker versus a legitimate issue?
Sure, Senator Johnson. That would happen in perhaps different ways or depending on what the nature of the claim or complaint was. If it is a wage claim, the claim comes in, we review it, we normally talk to the claimant to see what the issues are, to make sure that the claim is complete, at which point we notify the employer, send a written notice to the employer, notifying it of the complaint and asking for its response. In some cases, an employer...
Do you explore every single one of them?
When it's a wage claim that's made, yes. We respond to every wage claim. When someone comes to us and asks us to pursue wages on the behalf of the claimant, we do that unless we can tell from the filing of the claim that we don't have jurisdiction or there's some other issue that would make it impossible for us to act. But we do take the claim more or less on face value and respond to that. It's different when we receive complaints, because we receive, you know, thousands of complaints each year, and we don't initiate an investigation in response to every complaint that we receive. Generally, what we'll do with complaints is notify the employer that we have received a complaint about a certain aspect of the wage and hour laws, and then, you know, alert the employer to what the regulations about that issue are. But we're not going to delve into that as a complaint or start an investigation just because we have received a complaint.
Let me interrupt you. Representative Reardon.
Oh, thank you, Co-Chair. First time on this committee, so I'll play that card. Could you explain how you get revenue through the prevailing wage? It's on one chart up, one page up.
Oh, the prevailing wage? It's a fee that public agencies pay when they award a public works contract. So if a public agency awards a contract for $1 million for a building project, they will pay a percentage of that contract amount to us as a fee, which then goes for enforcement of the prevailing wage regulations and the education that we do around prevailing wages.
Okay, great. Thank you. It just wasn't immediately obvious that.
Okay, please continue.
And as I was saying, speaking of the complaints that we receive, this is also the basic information that we use for our proactive investigations and enforcement unit. We'll look at the complaints we receive to see if there are any kinds of patterns of industries or work locations where we think we should follow up by sending our proactive enforcement team to look at, to talk to those businesses and to talk to the employees in those businesses to ascertain or try to ascertain whether there are any wage and hour regulations that need to be enforced in those areas. So, for example, this unit began its work, I think, mid to late summer. We started out in the food processing industry because we do receive complaints against that industry, and it's a seasonal kind of work, so it was a good time to look at them. You know, they stopped in at businesses out at the coast, fish canneries, for example. They stopped in some fruit processing plants in the Willamette Valley. They traveled out to Eastern Oregon to look at some of the meatpacking and other kinds of food processing organizations out there. They talked to the employers about their policies and practices. They talked to the employees to see whether there are any issues. And then, you know, as they take a look at these businesses, they try to get ahead of any kind of issues that might come up and perhaps preclude wage claims from actually being filed down the road.
I'm curious as to the composition of that team, and let me be blunt in my question. I'm looking for evidence that you've got a team out in the field hunting for problems. I presume they're dropping in unannounced on employers, and I'm just curious how you place people on that team to avoid the perception or the reality of bias as they discharge their jobs.
Senator Johnson, I guess I'm not quite understand the question. What would constitute?
Have any of those the team members been employers? What's the background? How do you not show up at a fish processing plant with the assumption that there's something wrong and you're there to find it and shine a bright light on it?
Senator Johnson, well, as far as the background of the investigators go, that they're all investigators who have been with the agency for quite some time, so they're very well versed in the wage and hour regulations. As far as whether any of them have been business owners, that I don't know.
Well, I'm not. Don't focus in on that.
No.
What I really want is, how do you avoid them arriving someplace with a predisposition to find something amiss?
Well, I think part of that goes back to how we strategize even what businesses to visit. As I mentioned, we're looking at the complaints that we get, and we're trying to, we want to direct our resources to places where we think it will actually help. We don't want to just drop in someplace and find, you know, if everything is compliant or if we don't receive complaints against a certain kind of business, we don't want to misdirect our resources there. So we want to go into to areas where we think there's a greater likelihood that there might be some issues.
I'll be honest, what prompted my question is Senator Hansel and I represent a lot of food processors, and I just want to make sure on behalf of districts that still draw economies out of a natural resource base that there isn't an embedded bias that you've picked out food processors as being bad actors. You've suggested that you get a lot of complaints there. And I'm just trying to understand, if I were a potato processor, an onion processor out in Eastern Oregon, when your team arrives, what's my expectation as far as, you know, fair treatment or absence of bias or assistance to the employee side of the ledger, I mean the employer side of the ledger, as much as to the employee side of the ledger?
Senator Johnson, when we do visit a workplace, I mean, we always make contact first and foremost with the employer and let the employer know why we're there and what we intend to do. From speaking with the investigators, I think on the whole, they've gotten very good reception from employers in the places where they've gone, some of whom have actually, you know, appreciated, I think, the, not to say the attention that they've received, but the fact that the investigators have worked with them around certain issues which may be complex, which maybe they weren't aware of or weren't thinking about. For example, you know, sick time regulations are new, and so these are some kinds of things that they've worked through along with the unit to get their policies into compliance.
I'm sorry, Representative Noble.
Unless you had a follow-up.
I don't.
I have actually a follow-up to your question, if that's all right.
Please.
From my perspective, after close to three decades in law enforcement, I understand the idea of you go to where you expect crime to happen. But I think what you also said, and this is some of what we dealt with, is if you only go to those places where you expect there to be a problem, you go in with predisposed to expect to find a problem. And I think that may be, and not to speak for you, Senator, but that may be part of it. I would suggest that you may, similar to what we're seeing in law enforcement, look for ways to find people doing it right.
Thank you for more artfully stating my question. Please respond.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Representative Noble, thank you for those words. I think there's something to be said for that. I mean, I guess the problem that we face is we have, you know, three people for the entire state. And, I mean, we can, I suppose, go into all industries and without, you know, looking at, say, complaint history. And I don't want to suggest that we're going to businesses only because we've gotten complaints against those businesses. Sometimes, you know, we haven't. They just happen to be within a certain industry in a geographic area that we don't oftentimes get to. So we're making an effort, you know, to reach out in those areas. But I think thus far as the results of these investigations go, like I said, we're getting good cooperation from the employers. And in many cases, you know, we're not pursuing anything further. We're not pursuing, say, wages. There may be some, say, technical violations, which we're working to correct. But it's not as if, you know, we're following every violation to a civil penalty or something of that nature.
I guess I was just concerned that Representative Noble stated it well. I just deduced from your early comments, we go to where there are complaints, ergo we go to food processors. And that just put me right straight off, if you want.
I'm sorry. And, you know, we did go to food processors, and as I mentioned, part of that reason was because of the seasonal nature of the work. We wanted to get in those places where we could speak with those employees when they were there. For example, right now, we're looking more at motels. I'm sure at some point we're going to be looking at, say, you know, restaurants around the state and those kinds of businesses. So it's not meant to just focus solely on a particular industry, but, you know, as I mentioned before, to direct our resources to those places where we think we can be of the most help.
And are you concluded with your presentation? Have we interrupted you sufficiently that you've launched?
No, I'm not, but I can I can move on. I think some of the statistics here, too, I don't want to suggest that all that the wage and hour division does is just, you know, in terms of compliance, is just investigate claims and complaints. There's various ways of gaining compliance, and one of those is to educate people about what the regulations are. As you can see, agency staff field about 35,000 inquiries per year. Those are, you know, telephone inquiries or email inquiries from predominantly workers, but employers as well, concerning what the regulations are, what they mean, what people's rights are under the law. We issue about 3,700 employment certificates to employers so that they can employ minors in the state. And part of that process is sort of a screening process to make sure that employers aren't hiring minors to do work which isn't safe for them to do. Under both state and federal law, there are so-called hazardous occupations for which minors aren't eligible to work. And so we're trying to make sure that employers, when they do employ minors, steer them away from those kinds of work activities. And we also license about 400 farm, forest, and construction labor contractors each year. And there the goal is to make sure that when, you know, agricultural workers, forest workers are employed by a labor contractor, there's a good likelihood that they're going to be paid for the work that they do, that there is insurance covering the work for when they're working, that if they're being transported by the contractor in vehicles, that the contractor has insurance, so that, that these workers are protected also in their workplace. This slide is a performance measure of ours. It's actually a composite slide, including various activities around a wage claim, both the intake and screening, which is basically when we receive the claim and review it, the demand letter, which is the notice that we send out to the employer upon receipt of a wage claim, and then the investigation. As you can see, in this last year, we completed about 83% of our investigations within the timelines, the performance measures that have been set for us. You know, this is the wage claim process is a very efficient and I think cost-effective process for employees and employers as well when there's a wage dispute on the job. A wage claim's filed, we try to get a notice out to an employer within 12 days. We give the employer about 10 days to respond. If it does happen to go to investigation because the parties are in dispute whether wages are owed or not, we attempt to resolve that wage dispute in 35 days. So from start to finish, you know, if someone does have a wage dispute from employment, that's a pretty pretty quick process compared to, say, you know, going to court, whether that's small claims court or through an attorney. I mentioned earlier we get about 1,300 wage claims a year. In the past year, probably, you know, 500 of those resulted in a collection on our part, that we were able to resolve that dispute with the employer and collect back wages. Another 200 or so were probably wage security fund payouts. Only about 100 or so of those wage claims actually resulted in the Bureau issuing an order to the employer saying, we think wages are owed, you've refused to pay, you know, here's a legal order, in response to which the employer can then request a hearing or court trial. So it seems to be a very effective way for employees to deal with wage disputes that they have with their employers. This is a statistic for our processing for wage security fund claims. As you can see, despite some of the difficulties in investigating this, like we discussed earlier, we do manage to get 87% of those resolved within the 30-day performance measure that we have. Prevailing wage investigations, As you can see, you know, we're below our performance measure in this regard. We have we set a goal for 90 days to conclude a prevailing wage investigation. We meet that goal in 54% of the cases. The difficulty with prevailing wage investigations that, as unlike a wage claim with a single employee, these are basically audits. So they're audits of a contractor's work on a public works project. So we're looking at you know, multiple employees working on a project over multiple weeks. In order to conduct these investigations, we need to obtain, you know, payroll records, time records, certified payroll records from various sources, and so even that process of obtaining the records can take some time. But nevertheless, in the last year, the prevailing wage unit, I collected over $2.5 million for construction workers on public works projects.
So I know you've got a couple more slides. We've had a request to have the commissioner come back up. So if you could sprint to the finish, that would
sure.
be lovely.
I think I only have one more. Prevailing wage predeterminations. As you may know, the prevailing wage laws have gotten more complex over the years with public-private partnerships. So a few years ago, the legislature enacted this process where BOLI would formally respond to questions from public agencies or developers regarding when a project is covered or when it's not covered. We're able to respond to those 97% of the time within our performance measure, which is 15 days.
I'd like to know in phase two how many of on what percentage you prevail versus
number we find to be covered by?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Versus where our court overturns you.
Versus?
If somebody takes it to court and it's litigated or.
Okay.
I'm trying to find out how many times you write when the question comes forward.
So how many times? Okay. So
we
how many
can
times
take it offline.
Appealed.
I want to leave ample opportunity for the commissioner to come back.
Okay. So in summary, the demand for services for the wage and hour division remains constant. As I mentioned, I think the programs allow for the timely resolution of wage disputes. We're working to protect employees' access to wages and working conditions on the job, and at the same time to support, you know, those employers who are actually large number of whom are complying with the wage and hour laws of the state.
Thank you for your presentation. While the commissioner rejoins you, Representative Reardon has a quick question.
Yeah, just,
and
thank
Senator
you, Co-Chair. Real quick, these types of charts would be more helpful to me, I think, if I knew how many cases on each one of these years. Maybe one of the years it was real low workload and other years more challenging. And then the question is, when do you raise the bar? And have you had that discussion about raising the target? Because three out of four of these, you guys are like knocking it out of the park. Prevailing wage, maybe not so much, but you're doing well. When would it make sense to raise the bar? Don't really need an answer, but.
Co-chairs, you raise the bar for us. The legislature raises the bar
95.
For us.
It will do that in the KP. Thank you for rejoining us, Commissioner, Representative, or Senator Hanselman.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. I just had a quick question here. Great opportunity to talk to you personally. But in the short session, we passed Senate Bill 454, which was the paid sick leave. And we've got another bill that's before us, 779, to evidently fix it. But I guess the question I have is that I believe that when Ms. Sparks testified that the department, assuming you in particular, were unable to determine legislative intent on 454. Therefore, if a family farm who didn't have a sole owner, which I would argue there are very few throughout the state, I think my family farm, for example, has three family corporations, but mostly family members. But because you couldn't determine a legislative intent, opine that those family members had to be counted because of the business structure in determining whether or not they were exempt. But on the floor, Senator Dembrough, when he carried the bill, was very clear, I think, in the questions and answers that they were not to be counted, as was Representative Hovey when it went over to the House. So the legislative intent, just was curious if either you missed it or you just didn't pay any attention to it, that they were to be excluded. And yet we now have to come back and pass another bill, or try to fix it. But I'm just wondering, how do you determine legislative intent, especially on that bill?
Well, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Hansel, this is Brad Avakian, Commissioner of Labor and Industries. We painstakingly go through the legislative record, the speeches on the floor, everything that goes to a committee, everything that is said in a committee, when we need to determine legislative intent. And frankly, we don't even get to an analysis of legislative intent unless we think that there is some ambiguity in the statute itself. I don't know that there is ambiguity in this statute. I think that the statute does need some clarification. If you would like, Senator, since you are near the end, I'd be happy tomorrow to bring to you the exact pieces that we looked at in order to come to the conclusion we did, or to get that to you outside of committee. But it certainly appeared to us that everybody was better served not by having these types of ambiguities litigated in court or through our agency, and that in fact, if the legislature did have a clear point to make on it, that maybe that was best done during this session rather than through our agency action.
I think I'm going to exercise the prerogative of the chair and say we'd like that answer tomorrow in front of the whole committee rather than offline, if you don't mind, Mr. Commissioner.
I would be happy to do that. And again, just for your scheduling purposes, we only have two other presenters, Amy Clare from the Civil Rights Division, Jennifer Germanson from Technical Assistance for Employers tomorrow.
Cool. So we can start with you and that query. And if you need additional information, get it from Senator Hansel. Colleagues, anything else as we wind up today? Ms. Deister.
I would just say that, yes, BOLI is back tomorrow, and we will also be hearing from the Department of Administrative Services doing their overview of the governor's budget, which I believe is about five slides. So,
great. All right, colleagues, anything for the good of the order before we adjourn? They're seeing none. We're adjourned. Thank you. So.